You're listening to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. Our guest this time is Dr. Margaret McCartney, a Glasgow-based general practitioner and author. She, along with three others, wrote an essay for the BMJ in mid-May entitled Making Evidence-Based Medicine Work for Individual Patients. The essay points out a few things about the guidelines that come from evidence-based approach. Among the observations is that guidelines too often discount the patient's role in decision-making. There are other observations, and we're fortunate to have Dr. McCartney here to talk about them. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. McCartney.
Thank you for having me.
There are lots of guidelines out there, aren't there?
Yeah, I don't think I even know how many guidelines there are anymore. But certainly there are heaps of them, and there are more every day. I get another alert saying there's a new guideline that I should be aware of.
And so you try to make yourself aware of them, but you can't be aware or compliant with everything because they often are at cross purposes, aren't they?
Well, they are. Sometimes guidelines themselves are in conflict with each other. Policy making and guidelines is another issue of conflict quite often. But one of the really big problems I have as a general practitioner working under pressure, we're making lots of decisions with my patient within the confines of a 10-minute consultation very often, is how to get really good quality decision-making in there. And part of the problem is that guidelines are so long and unwieldy that the information I really want, the really basic statistical information, is often buried really deep inside. So in order for me to try and make a rational decision with my patient, the stuff that is really useful is buried deep in there, may not even exist within the guideline at all. And so really we're questioning, who are the guidelines being written for just now? Are they being written with the primary purpose in mind of helping people make good decisions based on their values about what they would like to do for their health? And I think just now we've got an awful lot of information in guidelines, but not necessarily the really good information that would help me make better decisions with patients.
You point out as a paradigm the Alberta Cardiovascular Risk Reduction Guideline, which runs 2 pages in length. And I'm sure that you would like to see more 2-page guidelines.
Yeah, I think summaries can be really useful just to give me what are the heads up here? What are the pertinent issues? Because, you know, one of the classic examples is bowel cancer screening. So we seem to do an awful lot of fecal occult blood testing, but not very much in the way of telling people, okay, here are the potential benefits, here are the potential harms, written in terms of, say, absolute risk in a way that we can all understand and give each other the heads up on it. Same with statins, same with hypertension drugs, same with drugs to prevent osteoporotic fractures. There's lots and lots of preventative stuff we do, and I'm really concerned that we're not giving high quality information to people. And instead of the doctor's role in being enabling a conversation and discussing choices, we're kind of being corralled into being told what the correct decision is. But until we've asked the patient, how can we know what the correct decision is? I think we should know from NICE what the cost-effective things are to do. But when it comes down to putting someone on a medication for maybe 15, 20, 50 years, who knows, we should be making really good decisions about that.
A bifocal approach to the guidelines in your essay. I think you've explained that already, but explain the metaphor again.
We're trying to do two things at once. We want really good guidelines that give us a sense of what's happening in our population. You know, what is good for the population? What do we think the risks and benefits are for a population? But we're always addressing in the consulting room those facts for an individual person. So what we really need to know is what are the values that that person holds? What does that person want to avoid, or what risks do they want to take? So for some people, they will do anything other than taking a tablet. For some people, they want to take every tablet, no matter how slim the chances are they'll get a benefit from it. From some people, they want to use exercise to try and mitigate as many risks as possible. For other people, that's not going to be possible for lots of very good reasons. So it's about trying to really shape decisions which are based on evidence, which may not even be applicable to that patient. So we need to know, you know, is this patient typical of the folk that were in the trials which have generated these guidelines? So we really need a sense of where our person fits in with what's already known and what should be important for that decision for that individual. And in many ways, it's not rocket science. You know, it's actually quite straightforward. But then we've got ourselves into this mechanistic state now where guidelines have to be all-seeing, all-being, absolutely perfect, applicable to everyone, you know, so from the super specialist to the general practitioner, whereas we've actually got quite different needs a lot of the time. And until we know what our patients want, we really don't know what our patients' needs are.
You say that the quality of the evidence underlying the guidelines isn't good. Much of it is based, I think you said, if I'm quoting you right, about almost two-thirds of the evidence in one cardiovascular guideline was of dubious quality, not because the research was bad, but because it wasn't based on strict evidence on randomized control trials.
Yeah, well, we've got loads and loads of guidelines that are designed to be used by general practitioners, but the bottom line is that the data which these guidelines are based on are very not reflective of the patients that we have in the community, who very often have multimorbidity, who may be old, who may be frail. You know, it staggers me that we're applying the same kind of guidelines to someone who may be 85 and on 12 different medications already, with a 42-year-old who's otherwise fit and well. And the risks and benefits in these situations are quite different. And I think it's really wrong to treat everyone as a human machine that has to be put into a guideline factory and then told what they should be on and what they should take for the rest of their life. We're missing humanity in that equation.
Yeah, I've been reading your book it came out about 2.5 years ago, The Patient Paradox. And the subtitle is Why Sexed Up Medicine is Bad for Your Health. And so I was reading I'm about 10% of the way through it, and I was reading this section on statins, on your opinion about, giving statins to people who have no other indications other than, well, this might lower your bad cholesterol. So it's true that there is lots of sexed up medicine out there, but it doesn't necessarily translate to,
I agree. I think we have this really ridiculous situation just now in the UK, where we're pouring so much money into new pharmaceuticals, new technology. It's almost magical thinking that somehow we're going to stop death, stop all people dying, and make everyone perfectly well, make everyone's numbers, everyone's obsessed with numbers and measuring, perfect. And that will somehow mean that we're all virtuous citizens who will kind of live forever. And it's just completely crazy. We know that health inequality is a major problem. You know, if you're poor in Glasgow, you will die 20 years younger than if you live in a rich area. This is the problem. And any amount of statins will not sort that out. And we know there is really good evidence that says that if you are already healthy, you are most likely to comply with all preventative health interventions, be that screening or statins or whatever else. So if you aim all your public health strategy on preventative medicine that requires that kind of uptake, like taking a statin, taking a blood pressure pill, and taking up bowel cancer screening, the problem is that you're directly giving more resources to the people who are already going to live for longer. And you're leaving the poorest people yet again behind. And that's the major problem. So the theme of the patient paradox is that we keep doing things to people who are well and have got a small chance of benefit, while the people who really should be becoming patients, who should be getting particularly mental health treatment, which is an ongoing scandal of delays and obfuscation, they are the people who would benefit most from intervention, from healthcare services. And yet, because you have to almost advocate for yourself to get it, you end up being at the back of the queue again and again. And that's the paradox that I'm talking about. We're aiming our resources at the wrong people. I mean, this was famously described in 1.0 in the inverse cure law with Julian Tudor Hart in the early 1970s. And the patient paradox is really me saying, well, I think it's even worse than that now, because not only are we giving less care to the people who need it most, we're actually giving ineffective and harmful care to the people who need it least.
You've got a new book coming out in November on the UK's National Health Service. Can you give us a little preview?
So it's called The State of Medicine, Keeping the Promise of the NHS. And my conflict of interest is that I am absolutely committed to working in the NHS. I think it is the best health service in the world, but it has been systemically underfunded and run on short-term political populist policies that were based in no evidence whatsoever, have wasted resources, have put more resources to people again that don't need it, while ignoring the people that do, created more health inequalities, and it's just become this political football. And I want to see a new era where we run our evidence-based NHS with compassion, with professionalism, and with patients right in the helm, working out where we best go, having a system that's based on needs rather than wants, and really reprofessionalising where we work. I think the NHS is the best thing in the world. I have many friends in America who tell me terrible stories of what happens with inequalities, and it's a real big problem. And people who are right at the bottom of almost the pecking order seem to get less and less as we move towards a more consumerist model, which is bad for everyone.
If you could ask your colleagues here in the U.S. or in Scotland, there in the U.K., to do one thing differently next week in their clinics, what would it be?
Oh, they could teach me. I mean, I'm very average, stroke below average. You know, I don't think that I should be telling anyone else what to do. If there's one thing though, I think it should be have coffee together. We work in a system now where you're tethered to a computer all the time. And my worst days at work, the days when I feel most stressed and distressed, are the days where I don't manage to have 10 minutes with my colleagues to ask for advice, to talk about what I'm doing, to get their feedback, to talk about what we did at the weekend, just that kind of communality with other people. And it's so easy now when we're tethered to a desk, tethered to a computer, to be really isolated and actually quite lonely as a doctor. You know, and I need other people around me to support me and guide me and help me. So that's the only thing, but that's only my advice. I'm sure people would like to not take it if they want to, but I think the problem has become that we're atomized almost as doctors now. We're working to protocols, looking at computers instead of looking at our patients. And our biggest resources are the staff that work in the NHS and the people that use it.
Well, Dr. Margaret McCartney, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's lovely to chat.
That was the 203rd Clinical Conversation. The others are available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. My executive producer is Kristen Kelly, and we come to you through the NEJM Group. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.